This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, June 6th. I'm Eric Latch, writer and editor of The New Yorker's online news column, The Current, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden. Tuesday marked the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, when China's People's Liberation Army opened fire on pro-democracy activists, killing anywhere from a few hundred to a few thousand civilians. The tragedy came at the end of weeks of protests in hundreds of Chinese cities. Speaking to American journalists a few weeks after the massacre, Shen Tong, a 20-year-old leader of the protest movement, expressed optimism about the future of democracy in China.
The country is a people's country. The future belongs to our generation. The seed of democracy has been sown. They are going to bud, flower, and fruit. For the people who actively give their lives, their blood has not been shed in vain. The blood is going with the self-crowned emperors to their graves.
But in fact, the Tiananmen Square massacre marked the beginning of a new era of repression in Chinese society. Thanks to the government's effort to scrub the events from the national memory, including censoring all mention of June 4th online, many young Chinese citizens know little or even nothing about what happened at Tiananmen Square. Jiayuan Fan joins me to discuss the ways in which the protests figure into China's cultural memory at home and abroad, and how the Chinese government has successfully prevented commemorations of the events of 1989. Jiayuan, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, take us back to 1989. How did the Tiananmen Square protests begin, and can you tell us a little bit about who the protesters were and where their grievances came from?
So about 7 weeks prior to June 4th, a much-beloved reformer named Hu Yaobang, who was the former general secretary of the Communist Party, suddenly passed away. He had been a symbol of reform and anti-corruption. And when he died, students spontaneously gathered to mourn his passing. Grief about his death quickly turned to grievance. At the time, China was going through a period of rapid transition. Reform and opening had happened about a decade earlier, so there were all these changes in Chinese society as it transitioned into a nascent market economy that was quite disruptive. People complained about inflation, about cronyism, about the lack of job opportunities if you didn't have connections. Students were calling for democracy and greater accountability, the freedom of the press, and freedom of speech, none of which was happening at the time.
And when you say students, something I think it's easy to forget is that this wasn't just limited to Beijing. It wasn't just a Tiananmen Square protest, but that it was a countrywide moment. And can you just describe for us how big was it?
It definitely started from elite students, students at Beijing University and Tsinghua University. But it quickly spread because there were social grievances that affected more than just the elite class, like the lack of job opportunities, corruption, the lack of freedom of speech that affected the entire populace. So when it spread to other cities, protests were taking place on college campuses, but workers joined in because they were similarly disaffected. And when the protests swelled, it signaled the kind of alienation that all of China felt at the time.
So this is a weeks-long protest. How did it come to this moment of terrible violence?
So I think initially the leaders were surprised at the speed at which it spread to other cities. The party was at first split about what to do. Among conservatives and hardliners, they wanted to repress the students right away. Among the liberals, there was a lot of sympathy for the students and a desire to negotiate with them. And quite a few rounds of negotiations did occur. What marked a turning point was the visit of the Soviet leader Gorbachev. This was a momentous occasion for China. It was the first time a Soviet leader had visited in 30 years. He was visiting that spring, and the government had very much hoped to clear the square to welcome him. When the students refused to leave, that was a huge loss of face for the government, which turned some moderates against the students. The students staged sit-ins and hunger strikes, and the government felt like it was increasingly losing control of the nation and that the party was going to implode. And that's when Deng Xiaoping, the paramount leader at the time, stepped in and made the final decision to declare martial law. And from there on out, the government was determined to clear the square at all costs.
And from the side of the protesters, I mean, how present was the threat of violence? And was this something that was anticipated, sort of felt like it was coming, or was this just out of the blue?
Well, on May 20th, when martial law was declared, I think there was some sense that things were getting very serious. But you have to understand that it wasn't just the students who were protesting on the square, or nurses, doctors, professors, even ranks of the Navy. There were army officers on the square. So there was such a feeling that the entirety of society...
This is civil society.
...of civil society was on their side. Someone joked that the only people who are not protesting on the square are the top leaders of the Communist Party. So at that moment, I think it was very difficult to imagine that army tanks would be sent in to literally raise the people down.
Yeah. And so what do we know and how do we know about exactly what happened in the square when the army came in?
Two things. There were a number of foreign journalists already in Beijing in 89. When martial law was declared, they were forbidden from going to the square. So many of them saw what was happening from their hotel rooms. The state media is controlled by the government, so they certainly weren't broadcasting right. What was really happening by the time martial law was declared. There is a degree of uncertainty about what happened, and it's important to note that the communist government has seized on that uncertainty and weaponized it to a degree. They have said at some point that not one person died on the square, which is impossible to believe. And they have also said that speculation on the part of Western media is a way to undermine the communist regime. But because there was no domestic media on the square and foreign journalists were not allowed, there's no way to investigate exactly what happened. But from all eyewitness accounts, it was a bloodbath.
And what do we know about the immediate aftermath and the awareness in China of what had happened? In the U.S., you know, we think of the famous Tank Man footage as a kind of like real moment that the world was kind of like watching. But in China itself, what was that awareness?
The government was hyper effective at revising the narrative and at purging the history of what had happened. Almost as soon as it happened, they were incredibly swift in washing blood from the square.
Physically removing the evidence.
Yes, sending an army of people to do the cleanup of the square. In state media, the students and protesters were immediately cast as dark elements and counter-revolutionaries who wanted to destroy the country and almost dissolve it. The soldiers, those who drove the tanks, were thought of as heroes and defenders of the country. And that narrative has persisted, I think, for a very, very long time. The Communist Party likes to paint things in black and white, good and evil. It has done a remarkably effective job at scrubbing all mention of the massacre from textbooks, the internet, the classroom, you name it. So in that sense, it has rewritten history.
So earlier this week, you wrote a piece for The New Yorker about the collective memory of Tiananmen Square in China and the Chinese diaspora. This passage really struck me. You wrote, "In China, the past is never past, but it is frequently purged. The story is rewritten, the narrative reframed, the villains and heroes recast." How has that work been done, and what has that been? I mean, you alluded a little bit to the ways that that started to take place soon after the massacre, but how has that process worked in the decades since?
I think we have to remember the vertiginous rate of change in China over the course of the last three decades, especially with the introduction of the internet. China is now the largest surveillance state in the world. It has a formidable firewall, which is this digital blockade, which divides the global internet from the one that Chinese people use. And this sort of control of information has a profound impact on Chinese people's ability to appraise history and to assess reality. So to the extent that June 4th exists in the popular consciousness, it is a taboo subject that Chinese people know to self-censor. They know to avoid trouble by not talking about any subjects that could implicate them. The Tiananmen massacre is absolutely on the top of that list.
And tell us how you've experienced some of that yourself, just in your conversations you have in your own reporting, conversations you've had with family members in China. I mean, tell us how that works in practice, how you've seen it happen.
Right. In a conversation with my mother last night, I learned for the first time that my family's journey to America was made possible by the Tiananmen massacre. My father, who came to the U.S. to study in 1986, was scheduled to return in 1990. And if it was not for the Tiananmen massacre, he would have not been eligible for a green card due to, I think, U.S. policy to try to protect Chinese scholars who were already in the country at the time. It was because of his green card that my mother and I were then able to come to the U.S. So I feel very conflicted about my own journey west being predicated on the deaths of hundreds, if not thousands, of students. I was able to be a student in America because so many students in China died. And I have opportunities, both economic, social, that are not available to so many in China, and certainly wasn't available in the late 80s, early 90s.
Among them, your ability to openly investigate Chinese history.
Exactly. It's very strange for me then to talk about June 4th with the people that I am reporting on and with other members of my family. There are members of my family who refuse to talk about the experience with me. And then there are writers, scholars, intellectuals at the time that I chat with whose entire lives, I think, are built on that loss of faith with their country of birth because of what happened on Tiananmen Square. I feel a level of closeness with absolute strangers because of the way they're able to confess and confide in me about their innermost feelings about what happened in a way that my blood relatives cannot.
And what about the younger generation? What about the Chinese citizens born since 1989? The sort of like, how has the memory or lack of memory impacted the young adults and teenagers in China?
For many of them, the post-90s generation, as it were, they've grown up in a very different China with very different incentives. The students on the square in 1989 lacked political freedom, but they also lacked the ability to pursue personal choices. My dad was very rare in his ability to go abroad. Many Chinese students at the time, especially those studying the humanities, had very few prospects in the job market, so they turned their energy to politics. The post-90s generation are granted a much greater level of personal liberty in that many of them, middle-class Chinese, do have the ability to study in the U.S. or Europe and can pursue personal wealth almost to an unlimited degree. In that respect, they are much less incentivized to pursue political ideals, as it were. But still, I found it very moving and heartbreaking when I learned that last year, a student Marxist society in the top universities in Beijing organized to agitate for greater workers' rights and to allow workers at the bottom rung of society to unionize. And their act of collective mobilization was regarded by the government as threatening. And quite a number of them were detained, arrested, and a few were disappeared. So there's a spectrum in the way that young people react. But I think a good number of them have bought into the government's propaganda that the past is the past, and that for the sake of stability and for the cohesiveness and the preservation of Chinese society, the government did what it had to do, even if that meant the killing of civilians.
And can you foresee a future where that changes, where the memory of the massacre returns to China or is reckoned with in China in any significant way?
I think in the last few years, in the era of Xi Jinping, China has moved with rapidity toward authoritarianism, even totalitarianism. So the prospect of a real reckoning with this most significant event in modern Chinese history is diminishing. Nevertheless, I'm encouraged that the memory, to me, seems very alive in Chinese minds outside of China. In Hong Kong, there is every year the only commemoration of Tiananmen Massacre on Chinese soil. And for the 30th anniversary, there was naturally a considerable showing of support. And I think there is this sense that as long as the government has not properly accounted for its actions, as long as it refuses to grapple with this giant wound that it has inflicted on Chinese society, it will never fully go away. And yes, that wound might not be allowed to show itself within Chinese borders, but outside, it's still very, very much present, and it will never heal as long as the Chinese government refuses to, in a sense, atone for its sins.
Jiayang, thanks.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Jiayang Fan is a New Yorker staff writer. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program is produced by Alex Barron for newyorker.com with assistance from Kylie Warner. I'm Eric Latch, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden.